Bicatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today we are really getting into a challenging one. It's a book written, you know, right after World War II, dealing with totalitarianism. But
yeah.
Honestly, it feels like it could have been written yesterday.
It really does.
We're talking about Albert Camus's huge philosophical work, The Rebel, from 1951.
Yeah, it's arguably his most ambitious book. And our goal today, I think, is to really unpack its core argument. Camus was grappling with this massive ethical crisis, you know.
The big one.
Exactly. If you start from that existential idea that life has no inherent meaning, which he called the absurd because there's no divine rule book, well, then the question becomes terrifyingly urgent. Is everything permitted?
Right. Does absurdity mean we can just do anything?
Yeah.
Tyranny, murder, anything goes.
That's the abyss he stares into. But he doesn't stay there. He offers a powerful answer based on the idea of authentic rebellion. And that's why we think this is so relevant for you listening now. I mean, we're all swimming in these competing ideologies, aren't we?
Constantly.
This book gives you a kind of philosophical toolkit, a way to say no to injustice, to stand up, but without falling into that trap of becoming just as fanatical or destructive as what you're opposing. It's about finding an ethical way to act.
Absolutely. And to really get the force of it, you kind of need to know a bit about Camus himself.
Okay, let's talk about the man. He had a pretty remarkable life. Born in French Algeria in 1913, grew up in poverty, really saw colonial injustice firsthand.
Yeah, he wasn't some Parisian academic born with a silver spoon.
Mm.
That experience deeply shaped him. And of course, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 57. Died young, tragically, in 1960.
But what makes his viewpoint here so compelling, I think, is that he lived this stuff.
Exactly. He wasn't just theorizing about tyranny. During World War II, he was a key figure, an editor for Combat, the French resistance newspaper.
So he was right in the thick of it.
Daily, making those impossible moral choices you have to make when fighting oppression. He knew violence might be necessary, but he also knew its terrible cost, its corrupting influence. He wrestled with that.
So his earlier famous work, The Myth of Sisyphus, that was more about the individual, right?
Mm.
The lone person facing a meaningless universe, the eye against the absurd. How does The Rebel connect to that? Is it a shift?
It's not really a reversal, more like the essential next step, a radical extension, you could say.
Yeah.
Once the individual confronts absurdity, they can't just stop there in isolation.
Because you look around.
Right. You look around and see other suffering. You see injustice. So The Rebel asks, okay, how do we, the collective, respond to the absurdity of human suffering and injustice? It shifts the focus from I to we. It's a deeply communal philosophy emerging from that initial solitude.
That makes sense. And that shift from I to we brings us straight to the absolute core of the book. This really careful distinction he makes between two concepts, rebellion, revolt in French, and revolution, why the French terms, is just academic.
No, I think the French words carry specific nuances he wanted to preserve. Revolt, rebellion for Camus is fundamentally a moral act. It's a limited no, a measured response to something intolerable.
Okay, like drawing a line.
Exactly. It says stop. And in saying no, it actually affirms something positive, human dignity, a shared value, the need for limits. It's rooted in the concrete suffering happening right now.
And then there's revolution. Revolution, that's the dangerous one for him.
That's the dangerous path, yes. Revolution, as he defines it, is different. It's ideological.
Yeah.
It aims for total power, wants to tear everything down and rebuild society based on some abstract blueprint for the future.
Like the perfect state or absolute virtue or the classless society.
Precisely. It's always an abstract ideal. And that sounds maybe like a subtle difference, but Camus argues the consequences are catastrophic.
Why is that ideology, that abstract blueprint, so much more dangerous than the simple no of rebellion?
Because, you see, it justifies sacrificing actual living people now for the sake of that promised abstract utopia later.
Ah, the ends justify the means.
Exactly. And that, for Camus, is the slippery slope directly into what he calls logical crime. Systematic, state-approved murder. Not driven by passion, but by cold, calculated ideology.
Wow. Okay, let's dig into where he finds the grounding for that good kind of, no, the rebellion. He uses this powerful image, doesn't he?
He does. It's foundational. The image of the slave, someone who has always obeyed, always submitted, but then one day reaches a breaking point.
And just says no.
No, stop. This far and no further. That moment of saying no, that negation, is actually also a powerful affirmation.
How so?
Because by refusing the master's command, the slave is implicitly saying there's a value, a dignity that's being violated. And crucially, they believe this value applies not just to them, but it's a shared human thing. It transcends the master-slave relationship. It's a claim about a universal boundary.
And claiming that shared boundary, that shared value that pulls the person out of being alone and creates an instant sense of solidarity. We are in this together.
Exactly. And that's the bedrock for his famous line, I rebel, therefore we exist. The act of rebellion creates the we.
Okay, but here's a question. If that shared value, that line in the sand, isn't coming from God or some eternal natural law, isn't it just, well, a feeling, a shared human assumption? Why does Camus put so much ethical weight on it?
That's a fair challenge. I think he trusts it because in a world without divine guarantees, an absurd world, it's the only authentic source of morality we have left. It's concrete. It's not an appeal to some abstract principle in the sky. It's grounded in the visible suffering, the tangible shared humanity we witness when someone is oppressed.
So the ethical line isn't drawn by heaven, but by seeing your neighbor suffer and saying, that's wrong.
Yes. The slave is basically saying, what you're doing to me violates something fundamental, a limit that applies to both of us. It's an ethic born from experience, not abstraction.
Makes sense. But as you said, the danger comes when that demand for limits turns into a rejection of all limits. The metaphysical rebellion goes wrong.
It can go very wrong. When the justified demand for justice twists into a desire for absolute freedom or absolute power, that's where nihilism creeps in. Camus looks at figures like Ivan Karamazov from Dostoevsky.
Right, the character who can't accept God because children suffer.
Ivan starts from compassion, a powerful rebellion against suffering. But it leads him to that devastating conclusion. If there's no God, then everything is permitted. Compassion, unchecked, somehow opens the door to moral chaos.
And then there's the really dark end of that spectrum. The Marquis de Sade.
Sade is like the ultimate cautionary tale for Camus. He takes rebellion to its absolute extreme, embracing cruelty, destruction, absolute negation as the ultimate form of freedom.
A terrifying endpoint.
It shows that rebellion without limits, without that affirmation of shared dignity, just collapses into the rule of the strongest, into pure destruction. Freedom, untethered from ethics, becomes just another word for tyranny.
And this philosophical path, this metaphysical trap, had absolutely disastrous real-world consequences in politics. He points squarely at the French Revolution, doesn't he?
He does. He sees the execution of King Louis VI as, on one hand, a necessary rejection of the old divine right of kings. But it also blew the door wide open for unlimited human power, for human pride to run rampant.
So what filled the vacuum left by a god and the king?
Figures like Saint-Just. They didn't replace the king with simple freedom and limits. They replaced God's authority with new, abstract absolutes. Virtue, reason, the general will. Capital letters.
And if virtue is the absolute standard,
then anyone who disagrees with the revolutionary government isn't just wrong. They're an enemy of the people. They embody non-virtue. And therefore,
have to be eliminated. The terror.
Precisely. And that is the birth of modern logical crime. It's not crime born of passion or need. It's the crime of the state, the bureaucrat, calmly signing death warrants based on adherence to an abstract ideology. Camus saw this as a profound betrayal of the original spirit of rebellion.
And he sees this pattern escalating, particularly with philosophers like Hegel, and then critically, Marx, who essentially turned history itself into a kind of god.
Yeah, that's a major part of his critique. If you start seeing history with a capital H, as this rational, inevitable force marching towards a predetermined goal like the communist utopia,
then anything bad happening now?
Any atrocity in the present, like the forced famines in Ukraine, the Soviet gulags, Stalin's purges, can be rationalized. It can be explained away as just a necessary, maybe unpleasant, but ultimately justifiable step on the road to that perfect future. The end justifies any means, however brutal.
That's terrifying. So the key takeaway here is that revolution, the kind built on abstract ideology and future promises, inevitably ends up betraying its own goals. It becomes the new tyranny, often using the very language of freedom to justify its crimes against actual living people.
Which leads us finally to Camus's positive vision. If passive acceptance of the absurd is out and destructive absolute revolution is out, what's left? He proposes this idea of the thought at the meridian. Sounds poetic.
It does sound beautiful. What does it actually mean, though, in practice?
It's about finding a balance, a dynamic tension. It means embracing limits, moderation. It's the South, the Mediterranean sun, clarity, as opposed to the fog and abstractions of, say, German idealism or Russian nihilism, in his view.
So fight injustice, but don't become a mirror image of the oppressor.
Exactly. Fight the tyranny, but refuse to adopt the tyrant's methods of total control and abstract justification. Recognize that absolute freedom is an illusion, maybe even undesirable. But the specific, limited rebellion for concrete justice, that's not only possible, it's ethically essential.
And within this positive vision, one thing I always find striking is how he elevates art. Artistic creation becomes, for him, the highest form of rebellion. Why art?
It's a fascinating idea, isn't it? He sees the artist as someone who also rebels against reality, against its chaos, its fragmentation, its injustice. The artist creates a unified, meaningful world, but within limits.
Within the frame of the canvas or the structure of the novel.
Right. They impose an order, a style.
Yeah.
But, and this is key, they do it without destroying existing life. They create alongside reality, not by obliterating it. Art sets its own limits, chooses its form, creates meaning constructively. So it becomes a model for ethical action, rebellion that creates rather than destroys.
So the real enemy, then, is any ideology, political, religious, whatever, that claims to have all the answers demands total belief, total sacrifice.
That's the core danger. Real ethics, for Kappus, have to be grounded in something more modest, more relative, that shared solidarity, that recognition of limits born from our common humanity, that we exist, that arises from the I Rebel.
Let's maybe highlight a few key quotes or ideas from the book that really capture these themes. They tend to stick with you.
Definitely. We've already talked about the big one. I rebel, therefore we exist.
Yeah, that's the foundation. Morality isn't solitary. It's born in that shared act of resistance. It pulls us into community.
And maybe my personal favorite, which is just such a powerful counter to that revolutionary logic we discussed. Real generosity towards the future lies in giving all to the present.
Oh, that's brilliant. It's a direct hit on sacrificing people now for some hypothetical future paradise. Value the person in front of you, their dignity, their life now.
It's profoundly ethical, isn't it? Then there's the more cautionary, maybe tragic insight into how rebellion can go wrong internally. The slave begins by demanding justice and ends by wanting to wear a crown.
That really captures that psychological trap, the danger that the oppressed, once they gain power, don't abolish the system of domination, but just want to be the new master, reverse the roles instead of changing the game.
It's a constant risk he identifies.
Yeah.
So thinking about all this,
yeah.
How can we actually use these ideas? You know, listening to this, how can you apply it in a world overflowing with conflict and information?
Well, on a personal level, it suggests a way to handle difficult situations. Maybe it's a toxic workplace or a relationship that's become oppressive. The Camusian approach isn't just quiet acceptance, nor is it, you know, burning everything down in rage.
It's the measured no.
Exactly. It's finding a way to assert your boundaries, maintain your dignity, seek constructive change where possible, without resorting to either passivity or purely destructive conflict.
And thinking about social activism, political engagement, the book is like a constant reminder to be vigilant. To keep asking ourselves, are the methods we're using actually consistent with the just world we say we want?
Are we fighting for specific, achievable changes that reduce suffering now? Or have we drifted into pursuing some abstract utopia that seems to justify increasingly harsh measures?
It demands we connect our means and ends constantly. And underlying all of this is a call for profound intellectual humility.
Yes, be skeptical of anyone, any leader, any movement, any system that claims to have the final absolute answer and demands unquestioning loyalty.
When someone offers you certainty, especially about the future, Camus basically says, double check your commitment to limits and to the people right here, right now.
Absolutely. So reflecting back on the book now, what was the most surprising thing for you this time around, or what really stood out?
You know, revisiting it, what struck me again is just how sharp and relevant his critique of worshiping history still feels. The idea that atrocities can be brushed off as mere bureaucratic necessities or inevitable steps on some grand historical path, that logical crime, it really is the ghost that haunts modern history, and it's a warning we still desperately need to hear.
For me, I think it's the enduring power of that third way. He carves out this space between just giving up in cynicism and diving headfirst into destructive fanaticism. That insistence on moderation, on limits, grounded in that simple shared human dignity. It feels like the only truly sustainable path forward, ethically speaking.
It's a difficult path, but maybe the only one worth walking.
So maybe the final thought we can leave you with is this. If rebellion, true rebellion, affirms human dignity, How can you, in your own life, in your community, identify and support those necessary moments of saying no? How can you nurture that constructive resistance without letting it spiral into the kind of destructive, limitless revolution Camus warned us against?
Something to think about.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.